thing the next morning, didn't he? He came back to your trailer, and he told you he didn't want you to harm anyone. He told you to forget what he said the night before, and he said you could keep the money he'd already given you.
Today's the first time I've seen him since I sold him the rifle.
Did you plant the tree stand in his garage?
Beg your pardon?
You heard me. Did you toss the rifle in a place where it would be easy for the FBI to find it, and then plant the tree stand in Mr. Street's garage so the FBI would find it too?
I don't know what you're talking about.
You set him up. You're taking part in framing Mr. Street. Why are you doing this, Mr. Tipton?
I'm not.
Do you sell drugs, Mr. Tipton?
No, ma'am.
Does anyone in your family sell drugs?
Nope.
Do you use drugs?
Nope.
It went on like that for another 45 minutes. Grace hammered away, and Tipton denied. She accused him of committing murder. She accused him of killing two men in Sevier County. She accused him of being a drug dealer and a pimp and a burglar, and now a lying snitch. But Tipton was like Teflon. Everything she said just sort of slid off him. He stayed calm and didn't allow himself to be baited. She asked him three times whether he'd been promised anything by the government in exchange for his testimony, and he said no. He was there, he said, only because he'd been accused early on. He was there only because he'd sold me a gun, which I'd apparently used to commit a murder, and then had been stupid enough to hide poorly. I knew he was lying. And Grace knew he was lying, and Clancy knew he was lying, but he was good enough at it that I didn't think there was anything the jury could really lock onto and say, this guy isn't telling the truth. Clancy had coached him effectively, and he'd coached him thoroughly. In the end, Tipton walked out of the courtroom like an automaton, staring straight ahead. He hadn't looked at me a single time during his testimony, and I could only wonder what Clancy had done to coerce him into lying. Chapter 36. Once Tipton was finished, I checked out mentally for a little while. His testimony was almost completely false. But with the other witnesses Clancy had called and the way he had framed the narrative of the trial, I couldn't shake the feeling that I was doomed. It was as though the people around me were moving and speaking in a thick mist. I could hear them, but the things they said didn't completely register, and I didn't fully comprehend what was going on. I was aware that Clancy called a fingerprint expert who testified that my fingerprints were on the money James Tipton had turned over to the FBI. He then called the property manager of the chalet Mom, Sean, and I stayed in and used credit card receipts to prove that I was near Tipton's home that night. His final witness was Hillbilly, who told the jury that I'd told him I'd murdered Jalen Jordan because he had threatened to harm my son. He said I told him I enjoyed seeing the bullet tear into Jalen's chest, and that I would do the same thing again under the same circumstances. Again, Grace was a valiant warrior. She completely discredited Hillbilly as a jailhouse snitch, but things had gone so badly I almost felt sorry for her. After Hillbilly was excused, Clancy stood up and said, "The United States rests, Your Honor." My mom took the stand and told the truth. And sitting there listening to her after all that I'd heard over the previous 3 days, I knew the story Ben Clancy was putting forth was far more compelling than the one we were telling. When Grace finished with her direct examination of my mother, Clancy stood up and asked her three questions.
Do you love your son, Mrs. Royston? Would you do anything for him? Would you lie?
Looking back on it, I was a terrible witness. 6 months in what amounted to solitary confinement may have allowed Grace and me to talk privately, but it certainly hadn't sharpened my social skills. I was stiff and unsure of myself on the witness stand. I was embarrassed and humiliated that I was there in the first place, and the things I had to say were almost unbelievable, even to me. I blurted out the information that during my interview of Jalen Jordan, he had admitted to me that he had already killed two boys and that he was totally unreasonable, almost delusional, about what the outcome of his assault case would be. After being sternly chastised by the judge, I went on to explain that he had threatened Sean, that he knew personal information about him, and that, yes, I was highly upset. Did I say all of those things to Rachel and Katie and Olivia Denton and Bob Ridge and Richie Fells? Yes, unfortunately, but I didn't really intend to kill Jalen. I was terrified for my son. Jalen followed my mother home, for God's sake. Did I attempt to hire James Tipton? Yes. Did I give him $50,000? Yes, I gave him 50, not 5. He was lying about that, along with nearly everything else. Because I called it off the next morning. I swear, I called it off the next morning. I didn't kill him. I couldn't have killed him. I didn't own a rifle and had very, very limited experience with shooting. Yes, I had Jalen's address, but no, I didn't stalk him. There was simply no way I could have known he was going to be on the trail that day. No, I didn't own a tree stand. I'd never been hunting. I didn't kill him. Ben Clancy's cross-examination of me was surprisingly brief. He acted as though nothing I'd said held any importance at all, that I was simply another murderer lying through his teeth to save his own ass. He did stumble once, though, when he said, "Why would James Tipton come in here and lie to this jury?" "Because you have something on him, and you've threatened him," I said. I saw just a hint of surprise on his face, and I knew I was right. Clancy had coerced James somehow. But he recovered quickly, wrapped up his cross-examination, and before I knew it, the trial was over. Clancy and Grace delivered their closing arguments. The judge instructed the jury, and 3 hours later, the marshals came to the holding cell and took me back to the courtroom. The jury had reached a verdict. As I walked in from the holding area, I took a look around the courtroom. It was packed, not a single seat open, with people standing against the walls. Most of them I knew were reporters. I saw Richie Fells and Rachel, my secretary. My mother had managed to get a seat right behind me. There was no sign of James Tipton or Katie. Marion Jordan wasn't there, which surprised me a little, but there had been very little mention of the man I'd been accused of killing. Clancy hadn't introduced photos of him, and nobody had taken the stand to tell the jury what a great guy he was. I started thinking at that moment that a better strategy for me from the beginning would have been to lie and say, "Yeah, I killed the son of a bitch. He deserved it." I would have had a better chance of walking out the door. I walked over next to Grace, and we stood while the jury, 7 men and 5 women, filed in. The foreman was a man named Israel Gillette, who was in his mid-50s and worked as a mechanical engineer for Eastman Chemical Company in Kingsport.
"Mr. Street, will you and your counsel please rise?" Judge Gear said.
I stood, but it was difficult. My thighs were like jelly, and my heart was beating so hard I could hear it. My hands were shaking so badly that I folded them in front of me, hoping no one would notice.
"Have you reached a verdict?" the judge said.
"We have," Gillette said.
"On the sole count of the indictment, murder in the first degree, how do you find?"
"We find the defendant, Darren Street, guilty."
My throat constricted, and I found it difficult to breathe. I fell back into the chair, slumped forward, and leaned on the table while the judge thanked the jury for their service and people whispered loudly behind me. I heard my mother sobbing. A couple of minutes later, the judge asked me to stand again. Grace put her hands on my arm and helped me up. I looked toward the judge, but I couldn't really see him.
"Mr. Street, as I'm sure you're aware, the only sentences for first-degree murder in federal court are life and death. Mr. Clancy didn't file a death notice, and based on the evidence I heard with the threat to your son, I can see why. But the jury has found you guilty of first-degree murder, and it is my duty to sentence you accordingly. Therefore, you are hereby sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The Bureau of Prisons will determine where you serve the sentence. Marshals, take him away."
"It isn't over, Darren,"
Grace said, as the marshals flanked me and started guiding me out. I could barely manage to put one foot in front of another, but I also didn't want to break down completely in front of all of those people. For a couple of minutes, I withdrew so deeply into myself that I imagined I was an embryo, safe inside my mother's womb. But the embryonic sac was quickly pierced when we walked around a corner and Ben Clancy suddenly appeared.
"Do you remember what you said in front of the press that day they let your uncle out of jail?"
he said.
"I wasn't there, but I was told immediately. You said, 'Fuck Ben Clancy. He isn't going to be around much longer.' Well, fuck you, my friend. I'm still here. and you're going to a federal max for the rest of your meaningless life.
I stood there, staring back at him. I would have spit in his face if I'd been able to muster the strength. He pushed a pudgy finger into my chest.
And guess what? He said, I'm not finished with you yet.
Chapter 37. Clancy was right. With the jury's finding, my life had become meaningless. I can't even begin to adequately describe the feelings of hollowness and despair I experienced during the few remaining weeks I was in the Knox County Jail. I fell into a deep depression, slept most of the time, and rarely ate. I didn't call my mother when they forced me to go to the rec cage, and the one time she tried to visit me, I refused to go to the visiting room. I was simply too ashamed to face her. Grace came to see me the day after the trial, but I could barely look at her and don't remember much of what she said. I didn't think she'd done a poor job of representing me at trial. As a matter of fact, I thought she was excellent. But I was in shock, literally, from the reality that now faced me. She told me I would be transferred eventually to the federal penitentiary in Atlanta, where I would be processed and then sent on to Oklahoma, where I would be processed further before being assigned to my final destination. The last thing she said to me was,
I'll handle the appeal. We'll keep working. We won't quit, I promise.
And as for Sean, that too was over. The only way I would ever see him again was if my mother somehow was able to obtain visitation rights and then bring him to whatever federal maximum security prison I was going to be shipped to. Clancy had been right about that, too. I knew the feds classified prisoners based on a point system, and I knew that a first-degree murder conviction would run my point total high enough to get me sent to maximum security prison. They wouldn't send me to Florence or Marion, the so-called supermax prisons, but wherever they wound up sending me, it was going to be an ongoing nightmare. And then early one morning, Belcher showed up outside my cell door and started banging.
Get your ass up, faggot! He yelled through the door. Time for you to stop breathing the air in my block and move on down the road!
He and another guard hooked me up and shackled me. And I shuffled along the hallways to a holding cell near booking and the sally port. A clock on the wall in booking said it was 4 a.m. Two federal marshals wearing gray uniforms, black caps, and black combat boots came into the cell about an hour later. They replaced my handcuffs and shackles and chained everything together. They attached a black box between my hands that covered the lock on the handcuffs. The box also forced my hands into an extremely uncomfortable position. They pulled the chains so they were extremely tight and then moved me to another holding area. They called them bullpens, where there were about 20 other inmates, similarly cuffed and shackled. During that short walk, I realized it wouldn't be long before my wrists and ankles would be raw and my hands and feet would be numb. I noticed that only a couple of inmates had black boxes on their cuffs, and I found out later that the boxes were used only on maximum security guys. About half an hour later, a group of six marshals came in. A county deputy unlocked the cell door.
Let's go,
one of the marshals said, and I shuffled out to the sally port, bent slightly at the waist because the chain that connected my cuffs and shackles was so tight. Waiting in the sally port was a black and white unmarked bus. It looked like a generic Greyhound. Standing outside the bus were four more marshals holding assault rifles. The windows were tinted so darkly I couldn't see inside. There was a marshal standing near the door of the bus gazing down at a clipboard. As we approached, he looked up and said,
"Which one of you is Darren Street?"
I was about six men back, about 10 feet from the door. I didn't say a word.
"Did you hear me?" he yelled. "Which one of you worthless maggots is Darren Street?"
"I'm Street," I said. Surprised my voice worked. He walked straight to where I was standing. He was a big guy, maybe 6'4", and he towered over me. He leaned down and put his nose about an inch from mine.
"You ever heard of diesel therapy, boy?" he said.
"No." I tried to look through him, past him, anything but at him.
"You're about to get you a dose," he said. "A mighty big dose."
He backed away from me and said,
"On the bus!"
The line started moving slowly as the inmates in front of me shuffled to the door and awkwardly climbed on board.
"Back to front,"
I heard a voice say from midway down the aisle after I got on.
"You, sit right there. You, right there."
The back of the bus was full of inmates, about 80% of them black. I followed the herd and plopped into a small metal seat next to an extremely overweight black guy with dreads that hung to his shoulders. He reminded me of Medusa. The rest of the inmates filed onto the bus and sat down. There were steel mesh dividers at both the front and the back of the bus. The marshals sat on the other side of the dividers, four of them facing us. Their seats looked much more comfortable than ours. Just before we pulled out of the Sallyport, the big marshal stood in the front and faced us.
"Anybody that gets up out of the seat is going to get hurt," he said. "There ain't no potty breaks on this bus. You can talk, but you best keep it down. Chow in 4 hours.
The bus pulled out, and a few minutes later we were on Interstate 40, headed west. We passed Interstate 75 about 20 minutes later. To get to Atlanta, we would have gone south on I-75. We were headed toward Nashville. My feet and hands were both tingling in less than an hour because the cuffs and shackles were so tight. I heard men talking in quiet tones around me. Most of them were speculating on where the bus was going and when it would stop next. Others were complaining about their hands and feet. After we'd passed through Nashville and were near Jackson, a marshal came down the aisle and started dropping white boxes in everyone's lap. I opened the box and looked inside. There was a bologna sandwich on white bread, a small orange, and a half pint of milk.
"You best be careful what you eat,"
the guy next to me said.
"Yeah? Why's that?"
I said. It was the first time I had spoken to an inmate since I'd shared a cell with Hillbilly.
"I heard the man say diesel therapy. You're gonna be on this bus 18-20 hours a day for a while. What goes in gotta come out, right? You eat too much, and you'll be sitting in your own shit."
"Are you serious?"
I said.
"I don't know what you did, but you must have pissed somebody off bad. I've known dudes, they done it too. They're gonna drag your ass all over the country, man. Where you supposed to be going?"
"Atlanta."
"You'll probably hit L.A. and Oklahoma, and Lord knows where else before you get to Atlanta. You better just hunker on down and get yourself ready mentally, because they tell me there ain't nothing quite like it. It's worse than the hole, because you got the cuffs and the shackles on all day, every day. You're gonna be in holding cells in different jails and prisons for a couple hours a night, then back on the bus for another 18 or 20. You ain't gonna see a hot meal or a shower or phone for weeks, maybe months. I heard of one dude they kept on the bus for more than a year, man. Damn near killed him."
I shook my head and looked at the floor, wondering what else Clancy could do to me. He'd taken my freedom, and now it appeared he wanted my soul. Chapter 38. Grace Alexander watched Steve Morris walk through the rows of long tables toward her. He was a stocky, powerful man of 40 or so, medium height, dark brown hair parted on the side and cut like a politician's. He was wearing a charcoal gray suit with a gray tie and a white shirt, very professional looking, businesslike. She'd never met him, although she'd seen him many times and had heard him speak through sound bites on television screens. She'd read his quotes in the newspaper, and she knew him to be, like nearly all prosecutors, politically conservative. He had been, back before he unseated Ben Clancy, an effective trial lawyer who handled complex medical malpractice cases. Grace wondered how much of a pay cut he'd taken when he was elected District Attorney General of Knox County.
"Interesting place for a meeting,"
Morris said as he approached and offered his hand.
"It's a shame, really," Grace said. "There used to be people in libraries. This one is like a ghost town now."
The branch library was on the outskirts of Knoxville, a rarely used depository of printed information. Grace had called Steve Morris the day before and asked if they could meet. He'd agreed immediately.
"I'm sorry about Darren," Morris said as he sat down across from Grace. "I'm sure he understands why I couldn't reach out to him, but from everything I read and heard in the media and from people around the courthouse, you did an excellent job."
I'm convinced he's not guilty, Grace said. Clancy used perjured testimony to convict him. The entire thing was a setup. I think Clancy may even have had something to do with the murder itself.
Can you prove any of that?
Not yet. That's why I called you. Darren needs a friend. A real friend who has power and is willing to use it to help him.
He was convicted by a jury, Miss Alexander, after a very public trial. That isn't something that's easily undone.
I need to find out what Clancy had on his star witness, the man named James Tipton Jr. Tipton lied through his teeth in court, but I couldn't expose it because I'm not sure why he did it. Our investigators are slammed. They have more work than time, and besides, they're not really that good. I can't go to the feds because asking the feds to investigate an assistant U.S. attorney is like asking the army to investigate a general. If they find anything, they'll just cover it up and Darren will rot. But you have access to investigators, don't you? Do you have anyone you can trust who can look into this?
Morris folded his arms across his chest and looked out the window to his right. He pondered the scenery for a minute or so, and then looked back at Grace.
I don't really see myself getting involved, Morris said.
Why?
Grace said. She felt anger rising in her chest and told herself to remain calm.
Why don't you see yourself getting involved? I thought Darren was your friend. Didn't he help you beat Clancy? Wasn't he the difference in the election? Because from everything I've read, and I've read a lot, he was extremely influential. He practically put you in the district attorney's job.
And I've thanked him for it 100 times over. But Darren didn't help me get elected so he could take advantage of my power or influence or whatever I may have. He helped me because he thought I was the best man for the job.
And he despised Ben Clancy.
Yes. Yes, he did, and for good reason. But what you're asking me to do is extremely dangerous in a lot of ways. If you think about it, I could possibly wind up with a federal obstruction of justice charge if Clancy somehow got wind that I was second-guessing him and going behind his back talking to his witnesses.
So don't let him find out. Be discreet. Use informants. Lie, cheat, misdirect. Do that law enforcement thing.
I'm glad to hear you think so highly of what we do, Miss Alexander.
I'm sorry, Grace said. I'm getting upset. I need help. Darren needs help, and nobody is willing.
It sounds to me like you've allowed your relationship with your client to cross over the line from professional to personal.
My relationship with Darren is irrelevant here. An injustice has been done, and I believe a crime has been committed by a federal prosecutor. Maybe more than one crime. I'm simply looking for some help in holding him accountable.
Morris stood and gave Grace a patronizing smile.
A federal grand jury heard the evidence against Darren and indicted him, Morris said.
A federal petit jury of 12 men and women heard the evidence in court, heard the arguments of counsel, applied the law to the facts, and found Darren guilty of first-degree murder. If you think the jury got it wrong, your remedy is to appeal to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And forgive me for saying so, Miss Alexander, but trying to convince me to begin a clandestine investigation of a federal prosecutor on what amounts to a hunch, or perhaps intuition, is just plain stupid. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have work to do. Have a nice day.
Grace wanted to leap up and claw his eyes out. Instead, she said, Do you have any children?
What? What does that have to do with anything?
I was just wondering, since you don't seem to have any balls.
Chapter 39. James Tipton had changed his security system. He used to rely on the dog, but he'd upgraded. The dog lived in the house now with him, although it went against his grain to have the animal inside. James liked his house orderly, and the dog shed and occasionally vomited, especially if James got drunk and fed it pizza or a greasy cheeseburger. James had spent some money and hired a security company to install motion detectors around his trailer. He'd trained the dog to keep silent and wait for a command if an alarm tone sounded. The tones weren't loud. James didn't want the intruder, if one came, to run away. He wanted the intruder to come into the house. Once he breached the front door, James knew that under Tennessee law, he was fair game. A man's house was his castle in Tennessee.
Violate the sanctity of my castle, and I can use deadly force against you. I can kill you deader than damn it.
He wasn't positive something was going to happen, that someone was going to come for him, but he couldn't shake the feeling that Ben Clancy wasn't the kind of man to leave loose ends dangling. Clancy had been in contact with James nearly every day for a month leading up to the trial. They'd met at safe houses all over Knoxville and in small restaurants and bars in the tiny mountain communities around Strawberry Plains, Pigeon Forge, and Gatlinburg. Clancy had scripted every word of James's testimony, and James had followed the script to the letter during the trial. The trial had been over for a month now, and he hadn't heard a single word from Clancy. It made him uneasy, not knowing what Clancy was doing or thinking. On this Tuesday night, James had just come in from watching the Tennessee Smokies, the Chicago Cubs AA organization in Pigeon Forge, play the Birmingham Biscuits. He had picked up a six-pack of tall boys from the BP station, a pizza from a honky-tonk about 2 miles from his place, and walked in the door of his trailer just before midnight. He'd let the dog out for 10 minutes, retrieved him, fired up a joint, and was sitting in front of the television, half-drunk and half-stoned, when an alarm tone started buzzing around 1:45. The dog, who was lying on the floor in the kitchen, growled menacingly.
"Zeus, come," James said.
The dog walked over quickly, still growling.
"Quiet."
The only light in the trailer was coming from the television, and James quickly flipped it off with the remote. He reached beneath the couch and pulled out a sawed-off automatic shotgun that was loaded with 5 shells of double-aught buckshot. He unlocked the safety. The shotgun was ready to fire. James heard soft footfalls on the front porch. Someone was coming. James heard the doorknob jiggle. It was locked. There was silence for several seconds, then a loud pop, and the door flew open. A second later, a bright flashlight filled the empty doorway.
"Go, Zeus!"
James said, and the dog hurled itself toward the intruder. The doorway exploded with automatic rifle fire. Behind the muzzle flash, James saw what looked like the outline of a stormtrooper. Bulked up in a vest, black helmet, James knew his dog was dead. He fired 1 shot from the shotgun, and then turned and ran as fast as he could down the narrow hallway toward his bedroom at the back of the trailer. Before he reached the bedroom, he dived through the door that led to the small backyard and the mountain beyond. He could hear the rifle fire behind him, hear the bullets blasting through the trailer's thin walls, hear the whiz as they passed by him. James was across the backyard in 3 steps and into the woods. A thin cloud cover barely obscured the full moon, so there was enough light to enable James to see. And he knew these woods perfectly. He'd been in them since he was a small boy. He knew the trees and the roots and the paths and the caves and the creeks. He headed straight up the mountain and didn't stop for a full 5 minutes. His lungs were screaming and his thighs burning when he finally stopped, knelt at the base of a white oak, and listened. At first, he could hear nothing but his own breathing and his own heart. But after a couple of minutes, he flinched as 2 quick rifle shots rang out from below. The flashes put the gunman in James's backyard.
"You'd better run!"
a voice called from the darkness. It was, unmistakably, Ben Clancy.
"You'd better run as fast and as far as you can. You'd better crawl into a deep hole, my friend, and you'd better stay there for the rest of your life, because if you ever come out, I'll be waiting."
James leaned heavily against the tree and slowly shook his head. He'd given in to Ben Clancy. He'd made his deal, and now life as he'd known it would never be the same. He turned his back to Clancy and continued running up the mountain. Chapter 40. Diesel therapy was just as the black man had described it to me. I spent between 18 and 20 hours on buses or vans each day with the black box between my wrists and the chains tight between my handcuffs and shackles. I learned to stretch both my toes and my wrists while the marshals were hooking me up in order to give my wrists and ankles just an extra fraction of an inch. Still, both wrists and both ankles quickly became raw and bloody. I'd do my best at each stop to clean them, but there was no first aid available, no bandages. I traveled all day and most nights with desperate, angry prisoners and robotic, sometimes sadistic guards. For 89 days... I was not offered anything but bologna sandwiches, oranges, water, and milk. I became grateful for the food after a while, although I learned to eat sparingly. I can proudly say that I did not soil myself a single time during the entire ordeal. There's a saying in the legal profession that goes, if you're looking for Jesus, go to jail. Everyone there finds him. I didn't find Jesus during diesel therapy, and I didn't find God, but I did find peace. At some point around the halfway mark of the trip, I resolved that I wasn't going to allow these people or this system to kill me. I simply wasn't going to allow it. I resolved to survive, and I resolved to keep fighting for my freedom, no matter what it took. I would have faith in Grace. She would get my sentence reversed, or get me a new trial. James Tipton would recant his testimony and tell the truth. He would tell the world why he lied, and then everyone would know that I hadn't killed Jalen Jordan. I didn't know who'd killed Jalen, and I didn't know why James had said I bought a rifle from him. I suspected that Ben Clancy was responsible, but I had no idea exactly what he'd done to put that kind of pressure on James. My only hope was Grace. Grace would find out. Somehow she would find out, and I would be able to go back to my son and my mother, and I'd be able to practice law, and I'd rebuild my life. Once those thoughts began to dominate my mind, I formed them into a mantra and repeated them over and over to myself. Before long, I began to believe. And once I began to believe, all of the anxiety I'd felt during the previous months suddenly melted away. I remained quiet and cautious. I didn't smile and try to engage other people, but I no longer harbored the constant fear and hatred of my captors that I had developed. I accepted them for what they were. Misguided miscreants, sadistic, but apparently employable, and I rode out the days in peaceful, tortuous discomfort. Finally, the bus made its way to the United States Penitentiary at Atlanta, a foreboding hellhole more than a century old. My group was taken to the detention center that served as a pass-through point for prisoners who were either new to the federal system or being transported from one prison to another. The lighting in the hallways when we shuffled in was dim, and the small cells, stuffed with three or four men each, lined the walls. We heard catcalls and insults, but I looked straight ahead and kept my expression neutral. After being strip-searched for at least the 60th time of my journey, I was eventually put in an 8-foot by 7-foot cell with three other men. It had a stainless steel toilet bolted to the wall, but no sink. I noticed that nearly all the guards in Atlanta were black, reflecting, I supposed, the racial majority of the population near the prison. Most of the inmates were black as well, many of them with their faces covered in tattoos. I had seen my first man whose entire head and face was covered in tattoos while riding through Texas. He was a muscular white man with a shaved head, and one of the most terrifying human beings I had ever seen in my life. An hour after we got to our cell in Atlanta, we were served a small plastic bowl of cold oatmeal and a boiled egg on a styrofoam tray. I ate the food and, grateful to have the cuffs and shackles finally off me for an extended period of time, laid my head back against the concrete wall and passed out. I had no idea how much time had passed when I woke up. There was a commotion of some kind, and when I opened my eyes, the other guys in my cell were walking out the door. I climbed to my feet and followed, expecting to be directed to a cell where I would again be shackled and handcuffed. Instead, we were herded down the dim hallway to a large recreation room and told we had 1 hour to shower, use the phone, or watch television. I desperately needed a shower. I hadn't had one in nearly 3 months, and not only did I smell like a wild animal, the wounds on my wrists and ankles needed to be cleaned. I got in a line of more than 50 men waiting to use one of three working shower heads. When I got to the stall, I was directed by a guard to strip out of my jumpsuit and slip on a pair of shower shoes that was on the floor. I had no underwear. My only pair had become so rancid that I had abandoned it weeks earlier. I slipped into the shoes and was allowed approximately 3 minutes beneath the cold water. There were water bugs as big as my thumb on the floor and no soap. When my time was up, the guard said, "Turn the water off and get the fuck out." I was told to leave the shower shoes where I'd put them on and to put my jumpsuit back on. There were no towels, so I squeezed as much water as I could out of my long hair and beard before the guard ordered me to get dressed and get out of his shower room. I lingered for a couple of minutes at the fringe of a large group of men watching a television newscast. Radical Muslims were continuing to kill as many innocents as they could. Republicans and Democrats were sniping at each other over the economy and health care and who was to blame for the country's massive deficit. I shook my head and walked away. Nothing had changed since I'd last seen a television newscast the night before I was arrested 9 months earlier. Just a few minutes after I'd gone back to the cell and they'd closed the door, a single guard came walking up.
"Which one of you is Darren Street?" he said through the bars.
I shuddered and raised my hand as he inserted a steel key and the door swung open.
"Walk in front of me, that way."
He guided me to a room that was 10 feet by 10 feet. There were 3 steel stools. I knew immediately it was a visitor's room.
"That one," he said, pointing to the last stool.
I took 3 steps and looked down. On the other side of the plexiglass was the most beautiful sight I'd ever seen. Her name was Grace.
"Oh, Darren," she said.
A slight smile crossed her lips, but I could tell immediately it was a smile of pity because a tear slipped down her right cheek. I must have looked terrible.
"Is it that bad?" I said. "I haven't seen myself in a mirror in months."
"You're so thin," she said.
"Not really by choice."
"I'm so sorry,"
Grace said.
"It took me a few weeks of not being able to get in touch with you to realize what they were doing. Atlanta should have been a one-day trip, but I kept hearing you were in transit, in transit. My boss was the one who suggested they probably had you in Diesel. We started raising hell with anyone who would listen and finally got to someone in the Department of Justice who was high enough to put a stop to it. But by that time you were in Portland."
"I spent Christmas on a bus," I said. "I assume I have Clancy to thank for my tour of the United States."
"He denies it, but I have absolutely no doubt he set it in motion."
"And there's nothing anyone can do about it?"
"I'm afraid not." "Are you injured? Is there anything that might be permanent?"
I showed her the open wounds on my wrists and ankles.
"These will heal."
"It's too early to tell about anything else," I said.
"How are you mentally?"
I felt tears well in my own eyes, but was able to hold them back.
"They tried to break me, Grace," I said.
"They tried to dehumanize me and wear me down and turn me into a malleable piece of clay that would do anything they said any time they said it. And they did it, in a way. I'll do anything they tell me to do when they tell me to do it. To them, from the outside, it appears they've taken me over. But I learned along the way that in here, in my heart and in my mind, I'm still strong. They can't touch that." She smiled again, and I wished I could reach through the glass and stroke her lovely face. I'd barely said a word the last time I saw her.
"I've wanted to tell you I'm sorry," I said.
"For what?"
"For not saying thank you. For not telling you what a good job you did during the trial. For being such a lousy client."
"You don't owe me an apology," she said. "I'm just glad you're safe and still in one piece."
"What's going on with the appeal?"
"I filed the notice, but I haven't filed the brief yet. I still have a couple of weeks. We've been trying to find James Tipton."
"Tipton? He's gone?"
"Seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth."
"Clancy probably killed him."
"Don't say that, Darren. Don't even think it. We're going to need James Tipton to recant to have a chance on appeal."
"I know. The trial was pretty clean."
"We'll keep looking. In the meantime, would you like to know where you're going to wind up in a few weeks?"
"Love to."
"Rosewood. Ever heard of it?"
"No. Where is it?"
"About 120 miles east of San Francisco."
"It's a max, right?" Grace nodded. "Anybody famous there?"
"Probably nobody you've ever heard of. A guard was killed there by 2 inmates a few years ago, though. Expect it to be tough."
"I'm sure I'll love it."
"I've done a lot of asking around, Darren. I've talked to former clients who have been in and out of the system. You have something that will be of great value to you on the inside. You have a legal education. You're a real lawyer. That's going to help keep you safe until we can figure out a way to get you out."
I'll hang a shingle outside my cell. "Darren Street, attorney at jailhouse."
"It's good to know your sense of humor is still intact." "Listen, there's one other thing I need to tell you. Your mother finally got a hearing in front of a judge. She picks up Sean and keeps him overnight every other Saturday.
My eyes filled with tears, and I broke down. I was still crying when I felt a guard tug on my arm.
"Thank you, Grace," I said as the guard pulled me away. "Thank you for everything."
Late that night, I felt someone pushing on my shoulder. It was one of my cellmates, a white guy named Bobo, who I'd talked with a little earlier in the evening.
"Listen up," he whispered. "Macho Man's about to start up."
"What?
What are you talking about?" "See that clock over there?"
A clock on the wall above a guard station said 2:59 a.m. I nodded.
3 o'clock on the dot. He's done it the last 3 nights. The guards got really pissed off last night. Something's gonna happen.
As soon as the clock hit 3, a voice in a cell across the hall and 2 doors down began to sing the Village People's Macho Man at the top of his lungs. 2 guards, both of them black and both of them large, strode by our cell and stopped in front of the Macho Man's.
"Shut the fuck up!"
He kept singing. Within seconds, 5 more guards in cell extraction gear, Kevlar vests, knee pads, helmets, thick gloves, and carrying electronic stun shields, pepper spray, and tasers, came running down the hall. They'd obviously geared up earlier and had been waiting for him to start singing.
"Last chance, boy! Shut your mouth now!"
He went into the first chorus, full bore. They opened the cell door and ordered the other 2 inmates who were in the cell to get out and lie face down in the hall. As soon as the inmates were out, the guards went in. Macho Man kept singing until the stun shield hit him. I saw him go down and could see the guards kicking and stomping, but I could no longer see the Macho Man. They dragged him out a couple of minutes later with his hands cuffed behind his back. 3 guards pulled him along the floor right in front of me. Blood was bubbling from his lips, but I could hear him mumbling,
"I'm the Macho Man. I'm the Macho Man."
Dozens of inmates up and down the hall started yelling at them to let him go, to leave him alone, but the resistance wasn't as forceful as it might have been, and I thought I knew why. Had they become too vocal, or had someone thrown something through the bars at a guard, urine for instance, the entire place would go on lockdown. Nobody would go to the rec room the next day. Nobody would get to use the phone or take a shower or get any commissary delivered. There was a laundry room that I'd noticed earlier in the day about 50 feet down the hall from my cell. It was encased by plexiglass instead of bars, so the guards could see what was going on in there during the day when some of the inmates were allowed to use it. They dragged the Macho Man into the laundry room and turned off the lights, and for the next 10 minutes, we sat there and listened to the sounds of the guards taking turns beating him. I found it so ironic. Black guards beating a black man for singing a song that was written and performed originally by a black man. Eventually, they dragged him out of the laundry room and off the block, leaving a wide swath of blood in their wake. Silence came over the cell block then, the kind of silence caused by fear and disbelief and shock. I lied back on the concrete platform that was serving as my bed and stared through the bars. The last thing I saw that night before I dozed off was a rat scurrying down the hallway, dragging a bag of stolen potato chips. Chapter 41. The Macho Man died 2 days after the vicious beating the guards inflicted upon him. I overheard a group of inmates talking about it during my first trip into the yard at Atlanta. It was 5 days after I'd arrived, and suddenly, without announcement or fanfare of any kind, the cell doors popped, and we were able to wander around freely within the confines of our unit and the yard. The yard was about the size of 2 football fields, rectangular in shape, covered in asphalt, and surrounded by an electrified chain-link fence topped with concertina wire. There were towers at the corners of the fence, with stretches of catwalks between them. In the towers and on the catwalks were men who carried weapons of various sorts, from rubber grenade launchers to rifles that fired rubber bullets to shotguns to deer rifles to assault rifles. There were a couple of basketball courts on the asphalt, a weightlifting area, a track around the outside, and several areas where picnic tables served as mini casinos. The first thing that struck me in the yard, the first place I'd been where there was actually some freedom of choice, was that the inmates separated themselves by race. Hillbilly had told me that race was important, that I shouldn't hang around with members of other races, but as I watched and listened and spoke with more and more inmates, I learned that what I was seeing was a less than subtle return to tribalism. Races separated into groups based on geographic commonalities. Southerners tended to gather with Southerners, Northerners with Northerners, East Coasters with East Coasters, West Coasters with West Coasters, etc. There were further breakdowns by state and city, but race was paramount. The question that was commonly asked was, who you ride with? If you were a black guy from Chicago, but not a Blood or a Crip, you probably rode in the Illinois car. But that wasn't the only car from Illinois. There was a white Illinois car, a black Illinois car, and a Mexican Illinois car. If you were a Blood, you rode with the Bloods no matter where you were from, but you tended to hang around with guys from your home state or hometown, thus the term homies. If you were a white independent boy from Knoxville, Tennessee, like me, you rode in the Tennessee car. But there was a white boy car that served as an umbrella for all the white guys at the institution. There were a lot of gangs. The Aryan Brotherhood, the Dirty White Boys, the Nazi Lowriders, the Bloods, the Crips, the Mexican Mafia, all battled to stake out their claims on various prison hustles and territories. For them, it was all about money and power, controlling the flow and price of drugs, controlling gambling or loan sharking or stores, extorting money in return for protection. The gang members were easily identified by a combination of their race, their tattoos, and the accessories they wore. But there were also a majority of inmates who didn't join gangs, who just wanted to do their time and move on, because joining a gang meant you could be ordered to commit a murder at any time, and once you were ordered, you had to do it. If you didn't, the gang would murder you. The second most important reason for staying out of a gang was that once you were in, there was no getting out. Period. If you joined a gang and suddenly had a change of heart, the gang would greenlight you, which meant they marked you for assassination. Bobo, the cellmate who had awakened me the night the Macho Man was beaten to death, caught up to me as I walked along the track. It was a bright but blustery February morning, and I huddled inside the light jacket I'd been issued. Bobo was pleasant enough. He was a couple of years older than me, about the same height and a little chubby around the face. His hair was buzzed and his eyes were dark brown. He had a stocking cap pulled down around his ears.
"There's something I haven't asked you, man," he said. "Which way are you going? In or out?"
"In," I said.
"How long?"
"Life."
"Life? Who'd you kill?"
I turned and smiled at him. "Nobody." He started nodding.
"Yeah, boy, that's right. You keep talking that. Didn't kill nobody, not nobody, not no how."
"I've heard that somewhere before," I said.
"Wizard of Oz. But you ain't Dorothy and this ain't Oz. Where are they sending you?"
"Rosewood."
"You know it?" "Do I know it? I just spent 7 years there. Got sent to Rosewood because I stabbed this boy up in Hazleton. I'm almost flat now, though. They're processing me out to a halfway house in Tallahassee. Less than a year and I'll be back home, staring at the walls, going crazy because nobody will give me a job. But let me tell you about Rosewood. You said you don't want to bang with a gang, right?"
"No, I'd rather just stay independent. Keep my head down, run my appeal, and try to get out."
"What'd you do on the outside?"
"I was a lawyer, believe it or not."
"No shit! A real lawyer? What'd you do? Wills and stuff like that? Real estate?"
"I did criminal defense work." Bobo stopped in his tracks. I stopped too and turned to look at him.
"Man, do you have any idea the kind of respect you're gonna command the second you step on the yard? A murderer and a lawyer? I'm assuming you didn't snitch on anybody, that right?"
"Nobody to snitch on."
"That's good. That's real good, because they're gonna wanna see your paperwork as soon as you get there. You're gonna need a docket sheet, maybe a transcript of your sentencing. You have to prove you're not a snitch, because if you were a snitch, them boys of Rosewood will run you off the yard."
"What do you mean, run me off the yard?"
"It means just what it says. Convicts hate snitches. You come in with paperwork that says you got a lighter sentence because you helped the Fed somehow or told on somebody, The shot caller is going to walk you straight up to the security booth on your block and tell them you can't stay, because if you stay, you're going to get messed up bad.
What's a shot caller?
He's the guy that calls the shots for your group. He's like your congressman on the yard.
So if they think I'm a snitch, they'll kill me?
Well, they might not kill you, but they're going to put a shank or a knife or an ice pick in you. The people who run the prison know they're serious. So what they do is, if you get run off the yard, they put you in protective custody for a few months, and then they transfer you to another place. I've known dudes who did their whole bit in protective custody, moving from one federal pen to another, because they were snitches and couldn't hide it.
So the inmates actually tell the administration who can stay and who has to go? I said.
Yeah, believe it or not, that's the way it works. But let's get back to Rosewood. The first person you need to see is this dude named Big Pappy. Huge guy with a ponytail, doing 30-plus for drugs. He's got more respect than anybody on the yard because of all the work he's put in on the police. He's the shot caller for the independent white boys, and you're gonna answer to him whether you want to or not. Once you prove to him you ain't a rat, and once he finds out you're a lawyer and a murderer, man, I'm telling you, you're gonna have so much respect. You'll have dudes crawling all over each other trying to be your friend and hire you for their cases. Big Pappy will watch over you. You'll get rich, man, I swear.
I thought we couldn't have money.
Ain't you got anybody on the outside who can accept and bank money for you?
Yeah, I guess so. Bobo shook his head and we started walking again. He was nodding his head and smiling broadly.
Wow, man. A lawyer and a killer? I don't believe it. A lawyer and a killer. I wish I was you. I really do.
Chapter 42. The following Saturday, I stood in line for an hour in the day room in the detention center, waiting for one of the three phones. I'd asked around and learned how to call out. They would have to be collect, and it was exorbitantly expensive, but I hadn't talked to my mom in almost 4 months. I also hoped, since it was Saturday, that Sean would be there. I didn't know whether I'd be able to control myself when I heard his voice, but I decided I had to try. I had to stay in contact with my son. It was selfish of me to abandon him, no matter how guilty or embarrassed I felt. My fingers were trembling when I dialed Mom's number, and I could feel droplets of perspiration running down my sides from my armpits. The phone rang once, twice, and I took a deep breath. It stopped ringing, and I knew she'd answered. A recorded voice was telling Mom she was receiving a collect call from an inmate at a federal penal institution. It was telling her what to do if she wanted to accept the call and pay the charges.
Hello? Darren?
Hi, Mom. I heard her take a deep breath, and I knew she was fighting back tears.
Are you still in Atlanta?
She said.
Yeah,
but they'll send me to California soon. The guys here say it can be anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. Have you talked to Grace lately?
We spoke when she got back from visiting you. She's a wonderful girl, Darren.
Yeah, I think a lot of her, too. Listen, Mom, I'm sorry I didn't call after the trial. I was embarrassed, you know. Depressed, I guess. I didn't want to talk to anybody. Then they put me in Diesel for a couple of months. I guess Grace told you about it.
She did. And I couldn't believe it. Are you all right?
Amazingly unscathed. The places on my wrists and ankles are almost healed already. And I don't think there's any permanent damage of any kind. A lot has happened, but I'm still pretty tough.
You're as tough as they come. I've always known that. I want you to know I emailed every representative and senator in the United States Congress and told them about what happened to you. I've been absolutely raising hell.
Every member of the U.S. Congress? How many is that?
435 in the House and 100 in the Senate. Took me a long time.
You're a nut, Mom.
Hell hath no fury like a mother scorned, she said.
We talked for a short time about how things were going at her beauty salon, and about the progress of my appeal. I knew I couldn't keep the phone for long, though, because there were guys behind me waiting, and staying on the phone too long was considered a serious breach of prison inmate etiquette. Talking an extra 10 minutes could get you shanked.
Listen, Mom, I said. There's a line behind me, so I can't talk long. Grace told me you got some visitation with Sean a couple of times a month on Saturday. Is he there?
He is, she said. and I felt a lump in my throat. He's up in his room building something with Legos.
Does he know where I am?
He doesn't know you're in Atlanta, but Katie told him you killed somebody and are in prison. She told him you're never coming home.
Why doesn't that surprise me? I said. How did he take it?
I don't know. I wasn't there when she told him, but he was pretty matter-of-fact about it when he told me. You know how kids are.
What did you say to him?
I told him his mother was entitled to her opinion.
Did you tell him I'm coming home?
I let it go, Darren. We just don't talk about it. He's only here for a day every 2 weeks. I just try to make sure he has fun. I'm walking into his room now. Sean, there's someone on the phone who would like to talk to you.
I heard Sean say,
Who is it?
I heard some rattling, and then I heard breathing.
Hello?
His little high-pitched voice said. I bit my lip as tears burned.